Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, in his first State of the County address, Mecklenburg County Commission Chairman Mark Jarrell stresses some tough economic days ahead. The Riggs-Griffin case for a seat on the state Supreme Court drags on. The nation's only undecided race from the November election makes its next move through the courts this morning. North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis shares some of the threatening phone calls he's received recently over his support for some of Donald Trump's policies. The state House and Senate reach a compromise on another round of Hurricane Helene relief funding. One House member launches another campaign to legalize cannabis, while the Senate considers legislation to crack down on psychoactive hemp. And ICE arrests 24 people in Charlotte. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE's race and equity reporter Julian Berger. Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte, and Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. The alarm bells about potential county budget shortfalls began sounding last year at tax time, and the rumbles have been growing louder this week in his first State of the County address. Recently minted Mecklenburg County Commission Chair Mark Jarrell made an official warning of financial woes ahead.
Our revenue growth hasn't kept up with inflation or the steadily increasing demand for services. So in response to this reality, we'll have to make some tough and very important decisions to help us remain fiscally responsible and sustain the critical services that we're responsible for providing.
So why hasn't revenue growth kept up, Alex? Is it strictly because they didn't increase the property taxes to the full amount that Dina DiIorio, the county manager, recommended last year, or are there other contributing factors as well?
Yeah, there are a few different things. First of all, inflation. There's also just an increase for demand as the county grows bigger and bigger. And then there's that deferred half-cent property tax increase when the county commissioners didn't want to increase the property tax by a full 1.5 cents. They just did 1 cent instead. And county manager Dina DiIorio said at the time that that might not be the most responsible budgeting. So they might be paying for that later on with a higher property tax increase.
Joe, here's what the numbers look like. This is really hard to do on the radio because we need visuals, but the county is expecting $49.2 million in growth revenue next year, but it needs more than $61 million, we are told. And you reported that this is partly due to an extra $30.9 million for salaries and benefits and the need to make up $14.7 million from deferred property tax increases. So my math being subpar and below grade, I hope that I'm even close to being right about this, but the need for salary and employee benefits, along with the shortfall, is about $45.6 million, but the gap between expected revenues, what they say they need, $61 million, is only 11.8%. That's a lot of nonsense. Does it all add up? I guess that's the bottom line.
It adds up. The issue is that those are all things that the county has to do. And we haven't even gotten into the wish list yet. And last year, the county really depleted their savings account, if you want to call it that, to make sure that the tax hike last year wasn't as high as it was. They took away a half cent, so they saved taxpayers some money. But now we're in a situation where the savings account doesn't have as much money. You still got a sales tax increase knocking on the door because of the CMS bond package that passed by voters. And so they're in belt tightening mode, is the phrase that they've used over and over again right now, and looking for ways to maybe freeze positions, extend timelines on some projects, just find ways to save chunks of money so they don't have to issue cuts.
And they knew this was coming because they were told it would have to happen last year if they didn't raise the property tax to the recommended level. Mark Jarrell also hit on several other areas of note in his State of the County address. Economic development was a major focus. He announced several significant investments in that area. He stressed the county's commitment to workforce development. He talked about education and early childhood development. And he highlighted some of the county's efforts to improve health care, including an $11 million effort to build more primary health care facilities. Because he says meeting people where they live, giving them easier access to health care, is an important step in keeping our residents healthy.
When it comes to critical services, we also recognize that we simply can't rely on our residents to come to us for assistance. Instead, whenever possible, it's always important for us to go and meet our residents where they are.
He also reasserted a commitment to environmental stewardship, housing and food security, and diversity, equity, and inclusion. Many of those initiatives, especially that last one, fly in the face of moves by the Trump administration. And in fact, when it comes to DEI, Donald Trump has promised to defund any entity engaging in that effort. Alex, do we know if the county's commitment to those issues is going to put them at risk?
I haven't heard anything, possibly Joe has, but it seems like that hasn't come up at all during the state of address. It doesn't seem like something that is concerning the commissioners right now.
Joe?
I think where the county might be a little worried, maybe worried isn't the right word, but for future grant applications, just making sure that the language they use in them is aligned with the Trump administration's priorities and views on this subject. I think, you know, they looked at what happened to Asheville last week or 2 weeks ago when the HUD secretary said this Hurricane Helene rebuilding plan is filled with DEI language and it basically needs to be resubmitted. So that's something I think that the county is aware of and will adjust to.
And we're going to come back to that topic of DEI being included in some local area initiatives because we'll talk about another story later in the program where that same question comes into play. In November, Supreme Court Justice Allison Riggs won re-election to the High Court by 734 votes. They counted those votes twice. It was 734 both times out of 5.5 million votes cast. But her Republican opponent, Judge Jefferson Griffin, has been challenging both the results and thousands of votes, about 65,000 votes that were cast. Things have been quiet for a couple of weeks because the courts have been arguing over which court, federal or state, has jurisdiction. And finally, the State Court of Appeals is examining the merits of the case this morning. As a matter of fact, if you're listening Friday morning at 10 o'clock, they will start their deliberations. They're examining the merits, and they've delivered already what is described as a mixed set of orders with a piece of good news for Democrats and Allison Riggs and a win for Republicans and Jefferson Griffin. So, Joe, what's happened already? Fill us in on that.
A lot of legal maneuvering. This is definitely the most pivotal hearing that has happened to this point because they are arguing the merits of the case to the Court of Appeals. They aren't arguing over which court should be hearing the case. This is literally, we're talking about the crux of the lawsuit, the votes that Jefferson Griffin thinks should not be counted from a couple of counties in the state, voters who allegedly did not have voter registration information in this database aligned with what should have been on the registration form. All of them didn't do anything wrong in this case. They just registered to vote and then something got hazy and now their votes are in question. And then, of course, you got the voters abroad who are serving overseas and did not show their ID and another small section of voters. But this is about the lawsuit and whether these votes should count, the merits of the case here. And it is three judges. We don't know who they are yet, who will determine whether this, whether to side with Riggs, like the right. lower court did, or whether, you know, we enter into unprecedented situations here and side with Griffin. And we see what will happen after that.
Well, here's what we do know about those judges. First of all, the State Court of Appeals is predominantly Republican, and this three-judge panel will have two Republicans and one Democrat on it. Judge Jefferson Griffin is a member of the Court of Appeals, but he has recused himself from this. Riggs had initially asked for the entire court en banc to hear this case, and they rejected that appeal, and they also rejected her request to have Judge Tom Murray recused from the hearing because it is now moot, because it's not going to be told, not going to be heard en banc. He had evidently contributed to Jefferson Griffin's campaign, but so I guess we know that he will not be part of this three-judge panel if it's become moot. If the three-judge panel decides in Riggs' favor, does that end this, or will Griffin appeal it?
Griffin has given no indication that he wants this to end. I think he sends it to the state Supreme Court if the Court of Appeals sides with Riggs, just because of everything he's done to this point.
And I read yesterday that if North Carolina's court ultimately decides in Griffin's favor, Riggs may also bring the case to federal court. The election was 4 months ago. This is likely to drag on for a long time longer, maybe a couple of more months. And she continues to sit on the high court because she won the election, technically. And although a coalition of over 200 North Carolina jurists, senior state government officials, bar leaders, legal educators, and practicing attorneys and others have issued a joint letter to Jefferson Griffin urging him to drop his suit, he persists. All of this, of course, like so much of life today, is unprecedented. In this case, many of the federal cases we're witnessing as well are mostly involving Donald Trump. They just go on and on and on. So are these cases showing the flaws in the design of a system that was put together in a more civilized time that is simply not equipped to deal with people who won't take no for an answer?
I don't want to criticize the entire legal system here. I think the legal system is working as it's intended. I think you could argue whether this should be a case at all. But there haven't been any errors in the process. It's just taken a long time.
It's Charlotte Talks in the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE. Threats to political violence have never been good, no matter which side they come from. And this week, North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis released audio recordings of some of the death threats he's received in recent days. The number of those threats has been on the rise since the start of the Trump administration, and these threats are coming from people on the left in many cases because of Tillis's support for some of the actions Trump has taken in the last couple of months. Or are they coming from the right, but from people who think he's not MAGA enough, Alex? Which way is it going?
It could be both. The people on the phone calls aren't really explaining much of what their political affiliation is. They're more they just sound unhinged. But Tillis is seen as one of the more moderate Republicans. I think that some of the anger might be coming more from the left because of his recent votes and voting more alongside Trump. And I think there might've been some hope that maybe with some of his nominations for cabinet positions that he would have turned those down, and he has not done that.
This is not the first set of recordings, evidently, that the Tillis organization has released. But after hearing some of the previously released records, one of the callers that he released this time around said hearing those calls brought her joy.
My favorite one was the really old guy who threatened to. I think he threatened to bash your head in with an axe handle. That one was hands down my favorite.
So that sounds like a flippant remark. Is it? I mean, was she trying to make light of a bad situation? Or is she agreeing with the previous caller against the senator? Alex, do we know?
Yeah, Tillis, his office said that when he released this first batch of death threats, and that just led to this where people were calling back and saying more things.
Okay. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about that, about Helene funding, which is now on its way to Western North Carolina, one presumes, and Jeff Jackson back on social media. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Julian Berger, our race and equity reporter at WFAE News. Joe Bruno's joining us from WSOC-TV, and Alexandria Sands, a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Political violence threats, at least, have been rising in this incredibly divided atmosphere in which we live these days. And Senator Tom Tillis is among our public officials who have been receiving those threats, and this week, he released a raft of phone calls, recorded phone calls that his office has received, one of which said he might kill Tillis.
I might drive to North Carolina and shoot him dead in the streets like the dog he is.
Not stopping there, that caller went on to add that he hoped Tillis's family would get kidnapped and tortured. Not that it makes any real difference, but do we know if these threats are attached to any particular or statement or action that the senator has taken, or are they just hate voicemails where people are venting about the situation in general? Alex?
Yeah, I think it's just the whole situation. I think it's just the rise in political tension. It's the anger over all of Trump's really quick and his fast actions. The callers aren't mentioning specific policies. They're just... It just sounds like they're really taking out their anger on these voicemail messages. Or in one case, there was a staff member who answered the phone and said, hello, Tillis's office, and very happy and positive, and immediately got like bombarded with curse words. So I think it's just overall the political environment, and Tillis recognizes he's been doing this for a while as a politician, and he recognizes that there's been an increase.
Well, Daniel Kalin, I think that's how you say his name, he works in communications in the senator's office. He suggested the media should ask Democratic-leaning groups whether they are contributing to the threats. We've heard this from other aspects of things going on in Washington, that the Republicans are saying this is an organized effort by left-leaning groups and by the Democratic Party. Is there any evidence that this is organized or even being encouraged by left-leaning groups, or are these calls simply from very angry constituents?
I think it's just from angry constituents. I know that there's a group called Indivisible that Tillis has called out specifically, but there's no clear connection between these phone calls and the letter that he received, that he published, but he has called out that organization specifically for hosting protests and thinking that those could possibly be linked.
What, if anything, is the senator doing about these threats?
His staff has been told to work remotely when they know that there's a scheduled protest. There was one protest outside his office where they let the protesters come inside, and I think a group stayed, and they were like banging and trying to open and unlock a door. So I think that they might be working remotely more often. And also another thing is Tillis isn't attending as many town halls or protests. That's kind of what started this whole thing, is reporters were asking him why was he not in attendance. And he released these death threats. And he kind of said, like, if you think I'm going to go to these events, you're kind of crazy for thinking that, because look at the messages I'm getting.
Well, we'll keep following that, because I'm sure this will continue for a while, unfortunately. The House and Senate in North Carolina, the State House and Senate, had two different Hurricane Helene relief bills on the docket. The Senate bill provided slightly more money than the House. They met in the middle, passing a bill allocating $524 million toward relief efforts. And this week, Governor Stein signed that bill into law. Here's what Republican Representative Dudley Green from Avery County had to say about it.
We ended up with a very good compromise bill on this that we can send on. It is providing what is now our fourth round of relief.
So, Alex, what does this bill do?
It does a lot of different things. $200 million to help farmers out in Western North Carolina who lost crops. $120 million to rebuild homes in West North Carolina. $100 million for private roads and bridges. And then you also have $217 million in there for Eastern North Carolina, because we still have homes that are damaged from Matthew and Florence. We've talked about this before, but the state program, Rebuild NC, has been under some controversy because especially Republican lawmakers feel like they have not progressed quickly enough with repairing those houses from those storms, and that needs to be addressed while before we have another catastrophe. So that was put in there.
So this bill now brings the total spent on recovery to just over $1.4 billion, $1.4B with $1 billion. And the governor wanted the package itself to come in at about that amount, which would have doubled it. Still, he signed it into money, into law, just to get the money moving. But while he was visiting a farm in Haywood County last week, he noted that farms are important businesses too, but that we need to fund other small businesses as well.
There is some funding in the next Helene bill for agriculture. That's a good thing. We need to have some funding for small business owners. You know, farmers are small businesses, but there are other types of small businesses that also need help, and I've urged the legislature to provide that funding. It's not in the latest bill.
That was last week, before this bill passed and was signed by Stein into law. The Senate bill removed $15 million in support for small businesses after the House rejected it. But why would either body make such a move, given that so many small businesses were severely impacted by this hurricane? Why would they do that?
I'm not sure. It might just be the amount of need and the amount of money that they're looking at. I think that it'll probably come up again. Just it's been such a topic of conversation with this bill. And I think that the governor has said he's going to submit another funding request soon. House Speaker has said that he's going to start working on the fifth bill soon. So I think it should come up again. This bill did have $55 million to try to fix infrastructure around small businesses. So things like sidewalks and parking spaces to make sure, you know, customers can actually get to the restaurants and shops and whatnot.
So I guess hopefully there will be some relief in a future bill. We'll find out as time goes on. As we all know, affordable housing is in short supply just about everywhere, and certainly in Charlotte as well as other parts of the state. And that's due to many factors, including rising rents, which have been growing much faster than they did in the past. Some officials believe that may be due to the maneuvers of one company and property managers across the state who they allege have created a cartel. Last year, when Attorney General Josh Stein called out a company called RealPage, first of all, when he called them out, what is he alleging that they do, Joe?
He is basically alleging that these apartment complexes are accessing non-public data and they are working together to set rent prices along the same lines that may be more expensive than what they actually should be charging and maybe wouldn't otherwise be charging had they not had access to this data.
So the software that this company, RealPage, offers to landlords is called YieldStar, and it makes real-time data available so that landlords and property managers can maximize their profits. That's capitalism. We may not like it, but is it illegal? The state thinks so. And so not only has the investigation into RealPage continued under Jeff Jackson as Attorney General, Jackson feels so strongly about this that he returned to social media to let us know that about the case the state has built against them and let us know that that is his top priority.
So instead of competing against each other, by using this AI software, these landlords can quietly work together and replace competition with collusion. That is unlawful price fixing.
He says this affects 70,000 people in the state, and so he's taking these people to court. Not the 70,000, but the RealPage people. Okay, no argument. It does seem to have a price-fixing nature to it. But doesn't that happen with almost everything? I mean, if you try to buy a big-screen television at a big-box store, and you look at the price tag, and you go to another big-box store at the same TV, it is the same price. And then you go online at the same TV, and it is the same price. What's the difference here?
Well, these are all different apartment complexes. And, you know, if one's charging $1,700 for a one-bedroom, a similar apartment complex is going to say, okay, well, let's just all charge $1,700 for this one bedroom. And it might be worth only $1,100 if you were looking for that same apartment somewhere else with a different owner. So I think that this is one of the most people are so passionate about this, especially if you ever search for an apartment, because it's extremely frustrating, the rent prices that people are having to pay right now. And so I think that this was a good case for the attorney general to take as his first real like public crusade on behalf of the North Carolina taxpayers, because of how rent prices, how high rent prices have gotten, not just in Charlotte, but in all of North Carolina.
But I want to get back to that idea that if you buy any piece of electronics anywhere, it's always the same price. I just don't understand the difference. What if price fixing is legal there, if people will buy, if you set your price at a market rate that people will pay, how do you make a case that what they're doing is illegal?
You also have to keep in mind all this data, though, isn't publicly available. This isn't something that the residents had the ability to review and challenge the methodology. We don't know what specific data they are using to make these decisions. And I don't know if Best Buy and Walmart are part of a database that, you know, says your 55-inch TV has to cost a certain amount of price. And then the two just both agree to maybe charge more than what that price is in the database. That could, you know, is that going on right here? I think that's the nature of this lawsuit, to find out if these companies are doing anything illegal and rigging the game against potential renters.
Okay, well, let's move out of Raleigh for a moment and bring this home to Charlotte. This week, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Division, ICE, arrested 24 undocumented immigrants here in what they referred to as a targeted enforcement operation. What do we know, Julian, about these arrests and about those who were arrested?
Yeah, so this operation, it happened March 1st through the 8th. It was a week-long operation. And they said they were targeting people that already had charges, that already had committed crimes. So out of the 24, some of them had aggravated felonies, some of them had illegal weapons offenses, some of them have property crime charges and DUI charges. And so it was mainly targeted towards specific people. ICE also said that they had arrested six people who had active detainers, but the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office did not honor those detainers. They also said 18 people who also had detainers are still at large. So they're still trying to look for them.
We'll come back to that detainer idea in a moment. This week, the United States deported without due process and in apparent violation of a court order three plane loads of undocumented immigrants and then transported them to a very opaque prison in Venezuela described as the worst in the world. What happened to the 24 people arrested here?
Yeah, so the 24 people that were arrested here, they're most likely in Lumpkin, Georgia, at a detention center called Stewart Detention Center. That's typically
you say most likely. We don't know for a fact where they are.
No. The problem is they didn't give us names of the people that were arrested, so we aren't able to look them up and see exactly where they were transferred to.
So ICE says that of those 24, six had active detainers, which the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office has not honored. Joe, what does that mean?
So this is ongoing debate, and it seems like every week we're getting a new statement from the sheriff and ICE about each other, and disagreements over House Bill 10, which went into effect last year. ICE issues detainers to people they suspect of being in the country illegally. They ask the sheriff to hold that person for 48 hours. They also ask the sheriff to call and let them know before that suspect is released from the detention center. What's happening right now is the sheriff is holding these people for 48 hours, not calling ICE. ICE says they need that call to know the person's about to be released. And every week now, back and forth, they are going, for lack of a better word, going after each other, blaming each other for the current situation.
And part of that back and forth, it was Gary McFadden, who's the sheriff here, says he contacted ICE to explain why it is important for them to tell him that these arrest operations are taking place, why they are arresting people, and to tell them what it costs his office to hold those immigrants. And he says if these people are dangerous, they should be arrested on criminal charges rather than on detainers, Julian. What's the difference? If he's being asked to hold them in the jail for a certain specified time versus hold them in the jail because they're criminals, what's the difference?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing coming from Sheriff McFadden is that he wants collaboration and communication with the agency. From his statements that we've gotten, it seems like there haven't been communication between him and the agency, and the communication are these press releases that ICE is sending out and that McFadden is sending out. There really isn't any collaboration, communication between both of them.
We're going to have Sheriff McFadden on this program for an hour on Monday on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. WSFC-TV Joe reports that Sheriff McFadden informed county commissioners on Monday that ICE has failed to pick up 163 undocumented people from the jail since December and that it cost the sheriff's office nearly $65,000 to house those detainees. Is the sheriff's office or the county reimbursed for that money by ICE?
No, that is county tax dollars that will be used to house those inmates. Now, he makes a good point about some of them because they have unsecured bond. Some of these people who are being charged and held on the detainer, maybe otherwise they would be released, allowed to go had they not had that detainer. And what he's saying is, ICE, listen, you're making me hold these people for 48 hours when they otherwise could go and you're not picking them up. That's his issue here, is them that the county taxpayers footing their two-night stay in the jail when ICE isn't picking them up. And what ICE is saying is, we don't have a chance to pick them up because you don't call us to let us know that they're being released. So that, again, it goes back to the back and forth. And when you ask the sheriff about this on Monday, he will tell you, I don't call them because that's not what the law says. And the law might say that in the future. I'm sure Julian feels the same way. It's just like, this topic, we might be able to figure it out if we got everybody in the same room for 15 minutes. But right now, they're just on way different pages. And so we are going back and forth with it as a result.
And Julian, McFadden told you that he doesn't know why this stands out as news, because law enforcement makes these arrests, this kind of arrests, regularly. But he'll have a chance to explain that on Monday, I suppose. Do you understand what his point is there? And I have 30 seconds.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing are these press releases that we're getting from ICE. This wasn't the first time that we got a press release from ICE explaining the people that they were arresting in Charlotte. Last week or the week before that, they had said that they had arrested five people. So it's these press releases from the agency.
When we come back, marijuana on the docket again in Raleigh, the legalization of it, that is, and we'll talk about that and more. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. That's why Joe Bruno is here. He's from WSOC-TV. Alexandria Sands reports for Axios Charlotte. And Julian Berger is WFAE's race and equity reporter. As the cutting in Washington continues, Charlotte is feeling the impact in at least one area. The Charlotte Center for Legal Advocacy says it faces more than $600,000 in cuts for its pro bono legal representation of unaccompanied minors. These are children who have come into the country without legal status and without a parent or guardian. Julian, how many such individuals are here in Charlotte or in Mecklenburg County?
Yeah, there's a good number. There's about 30,000 unaccompanied minors in the state and a few hundred within Mecklenburg County, so a good amount.
And Christina Cerrone is with the Charlotte Center for Legal Advocacy.
If a child is not represented, they're approximately 90% more likely to be denied, right, and receive a removal order.
So what makes the assistance of the Center for Legal Advocacy so important, it seems to me, is that I didn't know this. This is shocking. An unaccompanied child seeking refuge in the United States is not entitled to a government-appointed lawyer in immigration court. Why not?
Yeah, I have no clear answer to that, but I will say I was in immigration court Wednesday and I was astonished by that. I saw kids coming in, young adults my age coming in their early 20s without any lawyers, and they were there with by themselves representing themselves, and you would have the DHS lawyer on the other side going against them. So in immigration court, there's no they're not entitled to a lawyer.
Is that the case for adults? And if it's not the case for adults, why would you penalize children?
Yeah, so it's the case for anybody, adults and children.
They're not entitled to a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Bills to legalize the sale of marijuana have come and gone in Raleigh at the state legislature in the past many times, the latest of which was introduced by Mecklenburg State Representative Jordan Lopez on Monday. Julian, what would the Marijuana Legalization and Reinvestment Act, or House Bill 413, do?
Yeah, so it regulates and taxes the sale of cannabis. It also sets possession limits and enforces safety regulations. And one interesting thing about this is that there would be a marijuana tax. So about 30% of the sales tax, and those taxes would go towards individuals and communities, specifically communities of color, who have been discriminated against for cannabis use.
Representative Lopez says the time has come to join other states in this move to legalize cannabis.
So not only is this a widely used drug, but it's also legal in a number of states across the country and a growing number of states across the country. So let's do what's right, make it legal. Let's expunge records.
So the thing that leaps off the page here is what you just said, that they would tax this at 30% of the sales price. Big bucks possibly to be made there. But the other thing is that he's advocating for the expungement of arrest records for past cannabis-related offenses. Is there an appetite for that in the General Assembly?
In the General Assembly, no. I was speaking to Representative Lopez yesterday, and he was telling me he hasn't gotten any support from Republican lawmakers, but he is saying there's a big appetite for this bill from some Republican constituents, which he found very surprising, and he was very happy to hear that.
Do we have any idea what a 30% tax on the legal sale of cannabis might bring into state coffers? Do we have any idea what money we're talking about here?
I'm not sure. But I asked Representative Lopez that. I was like, that's a big number. And he said he's willing to adjust, and he's sure that that number will be adjusted over time.
Joe, do you know, Joe?
30% is a lot. What do we tax at 30%? Think about it. And one day, I'm sure it'll be interesting to see. Like one day, there will be pushes to reduce the lower the tax rate of marijuana. Like there are lower tax rates of other items and different things. This bill isn't going to pass, but it keeps this topic in the conversation. And I do think the Republican Party, led by Trump right now, is slowly trending toward the idea of marijuana legalization. Trump himself has issued some lukewarm stances on this topic. So I think if Trump were to do something from the federal level, maybe a bill like this would have a better shot. But right now, isn't going everywhere.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the state house in the Senate, Alex, a bill was filed that would crack down on the manufacturing, sale, and distribution of hemp. It's kind of associated. Why? Why would they do this?
Yeah, since 2022, when the law changed, there's just been this huge rise in all these products that you can buy or you can get high, from gummies to vapes to pizza. I have a story coming out today about Italian ice that you can eat and it'll get you high. So this is a bill to try to just like regulate this. And I think this is actually something that most people in the hemp industry actually want and respect, because it's been the North Carolina hemp industry right now, it's been compared to the Wild West. There's really very little regulations.
Well, as you mentioned, this bill passed in 2022, declassifying hemp as a controlled substance as long as it contains less than 0.3% of the psychoactive component of marijuana, which is delta-9 THC. So these substances that you've been talking about, gummies and Italian ice and things like that, that will get you high, are they thwarting those rules?
No, they're all in line with that rule. The thing is, they just don't they don't have clear regulations about age restrictions. So one thing the law would do, the bill would do, is to limit the sale of the consumable products to people who are 21 and older. It also would outlaw it on school grounds. It would add testing requirements. It would also add dosage limits, which I think will be a big deal. I think you can go into a store right now and get a Delta 9 gummy that's like 600 milligrams. And this bill has it set as no more than 75 milligrams.
Okay. Well, we'll watch what happens. Maybe they're changing their minds. Who knows? Controversy has erupted among members of the Cabarrus County Board of Commissioners. We never talk about them, Joe. We're going to talk about them today. This is erupting over the hiring of Sean Newton as the new Cabarrus County manager to replace the previous manager, Mike Downs, whom they fired. Remind us why they made that change.
In the official termination letter, there wasn't a specific reason, but what we have since gathered was it's a lot of frustration over the old ACN building and a purchased price that was well above the appraised value for the building. And they're using this building for Health and Human Services.
So Commissioner, Cabarrus County Commissioner Kenny Wortman, speaking at this week's meeting, alleged that there is a conflict of interest with regard to this new hire.
The way this looks now is horrific. It looks like the headline is going to be the county fires a 63-year-old man with 38 years experience, replaces him with somebody under 40 with none because he's your friend and former partner.
He's talking to County Commission Chair Chris Miesmer, who has a past business relationship with the new county manager, Sean Newton. But Miesmer told commissioners that relationship ended years ago.
He has never given me a campaign contribution nor endorsed my candidacy in elections. He has never done business with the county, nor are we in business together currently. Nothing illegal has been done.
And another commissioner, Laura Blackwell Lindsay, defended Newton's hiring, acknowledging that there is a history between Miesmer and Newton, but that the hiring was fair and above board.
Sean is qualified. He went through the application process just like everyone else did.
So this new county manager is scheduled to begin his new job on Monday. There was a vote to terminate this new manager's contract. It failed 3-2. And this morning it is being reported that the old county manager, Mike Downs, is now suing the county for $488,000 for breach of contract. Joe, talk about that.
Yeah, that lawsuit is basically over the amount of money the former county manager claims he is owed for severance. It's, you know, the rest of his contract plus the bonus that was promised to him. So it's about $500,000. And I think the argument will come down to whether he was fired for cause or without it.
So on Monday in Union County, the Union County Commission voted unanimously to ban events from county parks that are judged, quote, obscene, sexualized, or not suitable for young children. Julian, what precipitated that action?
Yeah, so this comes after the 2024 Union County Pride Festival that was at Chestnut Square Park. And community members were concerned about the lack of age restrictions for activities that were taking place at the Pride Festival.
And it should be pointed out that park, although in Union County, is not a county park. But who decides what is obscene, sexualized, or not suitable for young children?
I have no idea. I think it would probably
be... Do they know?
They probably would. Yep, they probably would make the decisions. And some Indian Trail Council members had concerns about this event, but they never took action. So that's what led the Union County Commission to take action on this.
So meanwhile, a meeting of the Monroe City Council grew tense as it voted on two controversial issues this week: the potential removal of the city's Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee, and a proposal to classify drag performances as adult entertainment. Ending DEI is all the rage these days in the Trump era, but council members there in Monroe voted 4-3 against dissolving the committee, despite warnings that it could result in a loss of federal funding. And they also voted 5-2 to table any discussion on the issue of drag performances, because some council members say they need more information. That frustrated those who believe that restricting drag performances is necessary to protect children. One member of the public who spoke at the meeting, Michelle Ball, told council members Monroe has an obligation to protect children from sexualized material.
It is not homophobic to want to protect children. It does not make you a bigot to want to protect children. It does not make you a fascist. It does not make you a racist.
Logan McGinnis, also a member of the public who spoke at the meeting, takes issue with that, saying it really reflects a broader assault on LGBTQ people.
Their protests and advocacy are not and never have been truly about protecting children. This has always been a direct attack on the LGBTQ community.
But Councilmember Julie Thompson took issue with that.
So to say and infer that we do not want to protect children is absolutely a false statement. I need more information, and I think I have the right to ask for it.
So why did the drag issue come up at this meeting of the Monroe City Council?
Yeah, so this all started last March in 2024. There was a drag show called Hello Daddy that took place, and it was basically a one-man show by a drag queen about growing up queer in the South. So a lot of residents in Monroe, they said that it was inappropriate for children, and it was a part of a, quote, like, grooming agenda. And the Union County Pride organizers who put this event on, they refuted these claims. You know, they emphasizes that the show was open to everybody, but that parents would need to supervise their children if they were under 14. So there were some restrictions, but this is where it all stemmed from.
And getting very quickly back to the DEI situation, they voted 4-3 against dissolving that their DEI committee. Are they not concerned about reprisals?
I don't think so. I think they did mention that they are going to tread lightly and make sure that whatever they do in the future follows the federal government's guidance.
Okay, Alex, the North Carolina Department of Transportation is considering building a temporary station at the site of the Charlotte Gateway Station for passenger trains. Why?
Yeah, the NCDOT built these tracks and a platform for the Charlotte Gateway Station, and it's been a few years since they finished that project. And ever since then, they've been waiting on the city of Charlotte to build the actual, I guess, station or the building, so there's a safe way for passengers to get to the train. And the city hasn't started that project yet. So I put in a public records request to kind of figure out what the temperature check was there, what was the situation. And found some emails where NCDOT was talking about building a temporary station while the city got to work on the actual permanent station. And along with that, the city is also going to build a development in partnership with a private developer.
NCDOT has already invested $84.6 million in new train tracks and the platform for the Gateway Station, but the Gateway Station is woefully behind schedule. It's Charlotte Talks in the Local News Roundup on WFAE. On Saturday morning, just before 8 a.m., a three-alarm fire on Moorhead Street near South Boulevard and South End engulfed the building housing the basement bar of Moorhead Social.
It was a lot of water they had to use. I know they had like maybe four or five ladder trucks.
Bystander Andrew Rogers talking to WSOC-TV about what he witnessed. Ella Hudson also told Channel 9 about the smoke.
It took like 3 minutes down 77 to be able to breathe because you could feel all the smoke in your car still.
So do they know yet, Joe, what started this fire? It was big.
No, and I don't know if they will because it was in the basement and it was heavily damaged. So it's unclear right now. It was an old building, though, and there were some inspection issues that weren't up to code, according to the Charlotte Fire. It's always sad to see a building destroyed, but this was this one will take some time to figure out what exactly happened.
It was almost an historic building because it's that old. The fire department estimates $150,000 in damage, but there was a complete structural collapse of that building. That seems low to me.
Yeah, this building isn't coming back. It's going to have to be demoed.
And we are we're going to close today on a happy, hopeful note. Dean Smith's name is associated with the magic of winning in the Carolinas. First, the original Dean Smith at UNC, and now The Dean Smith, who is in his first season as coach of Charlotte FC, he led the team to its record points total of 51 and its first ever playoff win. The good news has been compounded. That good news has been compounded by news this week that the head coach, Dean Smith, has signed a new contract that will keep him here through the 2027 Major League Soccer season. If David Tepper doesn't get in the way. And that is all the time we have. Julian Berger from the WFAE's Race and Equity Department, Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte, and Joe Bruno, reporter for WSOC-TV. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.